Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky interviews the world's top scientists, and we're heard over 15 million times a day. This week we have stories on glaciers, satellites, and navigating by the stars. But first, this week's scientist soundbite.
Puncajaya is the peak. It's the highest mountain in Indonesia, but the glaciers are actually very near to it. There has never been an ice core recovered from that part of the world. So in many ways, we saw our expedition as a salvage mission to get in and get these records while they still existed.
Scientist Lonnie Thompson of Ohio State University has traveled all over the tropics for his work, so you might be surprised to learn that what he studies is ice. Here's Beth Lebwohl to tell us more.
Hey, thanks, Jorge. In the summer of 2010, Dr. Thompson traveled to Indonesia. That's a nation made up of thousands of islands in the Pacific. And he went there to collect a tremendous amount of glacial ice. This ice was from glaciers found near Puncajaya, the highest peak in Indonesia. And he described his expedition as a race against time. And here's why. Glacial ice has been in Indonesia since about the last ice age. But because of today's global warming, it's melting and fast.
We were able to observe the loss of ice. First of all, this is the first glacier we have ever drilled where it rained every day on the ice. And when you think about losing a glacier, the best way to remove ice is to bring warm rain onto the surface of the ice mass. So we had one case where we had a tent that sat there for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, when we took the tent down, it was on a plateau of ice that was 30 centimeters above the surrounding surface of the glacier, meaning that we had lost 30 centimeters from the surface down over that two-week period. You do the calculation, you're talking about potentially losing these ice fields within 5 years.
I believe you described the ice near Puncajaya as a missing climate link. What makes that ice so special?
Well, when we recover these ice cores, we measure a number of different parameters. We expect we will get maybe 400 or 500 years of climate history in that part of the world. And so it's a very important history to reconstruct if we can. In order to understand climate change today, we have to know what the natural variability of these systems that have been operating for hundreds of years, how they have operated before humans started to influence the system. You have to know what the history has been of any of these phenomena to know whether what you're seeing in today's world is unusual.
He's measuring a substance called tritium at the top of these cores, which you can think of as residue from last century's atomic bombs. And at the bottom of the cores, he's analyzing some organic material. So both of these things will help him figure out just how much climactic history is, let's say, encoded in this ice.
Thank you, Beth.
Hey, thank you.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We move now from the mountain glaciers of Indonesia to a view from space of the world's forests. The Landsat program is a series of satellites launched in 1972 and run jointly by NASA, NOAA, and the U.S. Geological Survey. With its images taken from space, Landsat has created the longest-running record of changes happening everywhere on the surface of our planet. Here's Curtis Woodcock of Boston University talking about changes to Earth's forests seen with Landsat. Dr. Woodcock, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what's happening to our forests?
Well, different things in different places. It's kind of could be a complicated answer. In some places, we have Very bad damage as a result of pests. In other places, we have clearing of forests for agriculture and that sort of thing. Maybe two quick examples might help. One is here in New England, in my backyard, where after about 130 years of increase in forest land following the abandonment of lots of agricultural land, we now are starting to see decreases in forest areas as a result of housing developments and commercial developments and golf courses and all that sort of thing. Another example of a place we've been working is in the Ukraine, where following the collapse of the Soviet Union, we're now seeing an expansion of forests due to the abandonment of agricultural land. So some parts of the world are losing forests, some parts of the world are adding forests.
Explain for us, please, what these changes you described that are happening to forests really mean to ordinary folks like me listening now.
Mostly what we're talking about are a whole range of something called ecosystem services. And those are things that forests provide to us without necessarily a whole lot of effort on our part. An example is that they provide habitat to lots of species, and so biodiversity in many parts of the world is very dependent on forests. A big issue at the current time, it refers to carbon. Global climate change is largely a result of increasing CO2 in the atmosphere, and forests are a natural sink for CO2 and store lots of carbon.
How do you study how forests are changing?
Well, really, the way we do this is with satellite imagery. And the most useful satellite for this kind of work are the Landsat series of satellites, and they really provide the backbone for the monitoring of forests that's going on around the world.
Can you briefly describe for us the Landsat program?
Well, the Landsat series of satellites is kind of our oldest and most venerable series of satellites for monitoring Earth from space. And there have been a total of seven satellites that have been launched since 1972. They've been collecting data over the entire Earth for this long time period. So they provide, in essence, a record of what's happened on the surface of the Earth. And so what we do is go back and compare older images with newer images to look for changes between those time periods in order to track and monitor changes that have gone on.
That was Curtis Woodcock, a professor of geography and the environment at Boston University, speaking with us about the Landsat program. Back after this.
It's time to make a plan. It's time to understand. It's time for you to come full circle and start all over again. Start all over again.
You're listening to Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Today on Earth Sky's Weird Science on the Internet, Ryan Britton talks about a recent study that observed bacteria walking. Sounds interesting. Do bacteria have legs, Ryan?
Yes, in a way they actually do have legs. Some bacteria have these hair-like structures on them, and this month a consortium of scientists in the United States confirmed that bacteria can use these little hairs on them to actually stand themselves up on one end and basically walk around.
I hope bacteria don't walk too far towards me.
Well, that's right. It's good to know this information. Understanding how bacteria move can help us fight diseases that bacteria cause. For instance, this actual strain of bacteria that was observed walking can cause deadly infections in people with cystic fibrosis. So it's both amazing and weird to think of these microscopic organisms actually detaching themselves from a surface, getting up and walking around to find new areas, to find good spots to divide and multiply. By the way, you can find details on this discovery in the October 8th, 2010 issue of Science Magazine, which is on the web at sciencemag.org.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Ryan Britton with Weird Science on Bacteria with Legs. And you'll find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org.
Country ever.
new driveway. Rational behaviors make the system tick. Makes the human do the trick. Earn the pay, procreate and quick fade. Animal behaviors.
We're at Sky, a clear voice for science. Lindsay Patterson has a global health story for us about something called neglected tropical diseases. Lindsay, what are neglected tropical diseases?
Neglected tropical diseases are diseases that are found mostly in remote rural areas or urban slums among the poorest people in the world. They're diseases that we would have thought were cured or diseases that we thought may have disappeared off the face of the earth. Things like hookworm, rabies, and leprosy, they're still affecting people. They're called neglected because not too much attention or funding has gone to them historically compared to diseases like HIV/AIDS and malaria. But they're affecting about one-third of the people who live on under $2 a day.
Lindsay, are these diseases getting more attention now?
Yes, fortunately. Recently, the World Health Organization released a report on these diseases and then announced that they're launching a big campaign to prevent them, which is the biggest spotlight they've had for the global health community. I talked to one medical researcher, Dr. Peter Hotez. He's the president of the Sabin Vaccine Institute, and he's waited a long time for this kind of attention.
I've devoted my life to studying a group of diseases of poor people in low-income countries, and a few years back started an organization called the Global Network for Neglected Tropical Diseases to identify ways to start treating large segments of the world's populations that live in poverty.
Dr. Hotez, can you tell me why these diseases affect only the world's poorest people?
It's not clear to me that it's any one particular factor, whether it's poor quality dwellings, poor housing, poor sanitation, lack of access to adequate clean water, poor nutrition. More likely, it's some combination of these factors.
What kind of work are you doing to alleviate the impacts of these diseases?
So at the Sabin Vaccine Institute, we are pushing hard to deliver these rapid impact packages of drugs through our global network for neglected tropical diseases in the world's low-income countries. And at the same time, in our research laboratories, developing new vaccines for neglected tropical diseases. We call these vaccines the anti-poverty vaccines because they have an impact not only on health, but also on economic development.
What would you say is the bottom line here?
These neglected infections, just like the neglected tropical diseases, occur wherever you find the world's poorest people. And poverty is the overwhelming determinant. And very sadly, I think these problems have been ignored in part because it's occurring among people who have no voice. And we need to now give them a voice.
I hope they get a voice.
I hope so, too. Maybe one day we won't have to call these diseases neglected.
Thanks, Lindsay. Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
All around me, I hear the people say, choose to be the one who sees the world.
See the moon.
You'll find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. The global night sky is something that we're going to talk about now with Deborah Bird, who joins us in the studio. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. How are you doing?
Doing great. So tell us, what's up?
Well, today I'm going to ask you to use your imagination to picture in your mind the most distant human object from Earth. So the record for the most distant human object goes to a spacecraft, Voyager 1, which in 2010 is over 16 billion kilometers, that's about 10 billion miles, away from Earth. And this spacecraft launched in the year 1977, and it continues, as we speak, to travel away from both the Earth and the Sun.
So what's so special about Voyager 1 here that that allowed it to travel this far?
Well, Jorge, this little spacecraft was designed back in the early 1970s, and at that time, no spacecraft had gone as far as the planet Saturn, which would have been a four-year journey. So space engineers built the spacecraft with enough redundancy, and that's just enough backup systems, so that it could just keep going and get to Saturn. And keep going is exactly what it did. It went way past Saturn and has now been traveling for 33 years.
So like Newton said, will this object in motion keep going forever and ever?
Well, you know, it's interesting to think about that. And I guess what could happen is some other larger spacecraft could someday come along and pick it up. But if it doesn't, then yeah, it'll keep going forever and ever. And in the meantime, no human or human-made object has ever visited the edge of what's called the heliosphere. That's sort of a bubble around our sun.
Cool.
It means the sphere of the sun's influence. But Voyager 1 and its sister craft, Voyager 2, which is right behind it, are expected to pass through this bubble soon, and then they will literally be where no spacecraft has been before, in the space between the stars.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge. And I want to remind everyone that we have daily charts of night sky events at the Tonight area of EarthSky.org.
EarthSky's Deborah Bird.
Tip of Spain, found out the hard way that if a hole's in your boat, spices they don't float but make soup out of the ocean.
Lindsay Patterson is back with a story about how Pacific Islanders are sailing the world without a compass.
Thanks, Jorge. I talked with a Hawaiian navigator named Ka'ulani Murphy, who's getting ready for a voyage around the world in a Polynesian canoe. These canoes look kind of like catamarans. They have two hulls and there's a deck stretched between them, and they're about 18 meters long. So they're going around the world in this very small boat. But I should give some background here, because not less than 50 years ago, this traditional navigation was lost to Hawaii. People there had just stopped voyaging for what are still unknown reasons. But back in the 1970s, a group of Hawaiians decided to do an experiment to figure out how their ancestors settled their islands. They went to Micronesia and found a man named Mau Pialog there who still knew the old ways of navigating. So Mau taught them how to navigate without instruments. And one of the Hawaiians, a man named Nainoa Thompson, who is Ka'ulani's teacher, adapted Mau's teachings a little bit. He added modern math and science, even though there are still no modern instruments used on the canoe. I asked Ka'ulani to explain how it works.
What are the biggest differences between Polynesian navigation and how most ships in the world navigate today?
One of the biggest differences is that in Polynesian navigation, we do not use instruments. And so that it's kind of been called non-instrument navigation or wayfinding. And really, we're trying to relearn the way that our ancestors used to sail without instruments. A modern ship might have a magnetic compass on board and be able to steer their course by looking at that compass, whereas when we are sailing our voyaging canoes, we don't actually have a magnetic compass like that or a sextant or a GPS on board. We're just going solely off of clues in nature, such as the rising and setting of celestial bodies, the wind and the swells, things like that.
How is modern science combined with this ancient voyaging knowledge in modern Hawaiian navigation?
the basic aspect of the navigation is this idea of a star compass. And Mao has this star compass that he uses to teach his students. And it's really, you have your circle of horizon, and he's got different points along this circle, and those mark star paths. So you're watching for stars that rise from these points on the horizon, and that's what you'd use for figuring out your direction. And then when Nainoa learned from him, he developed a star compass that was appropriate for Hawaii. What Nainoa did was divided that compass into segments of the horizon, you could say. So the 360-degree circle divided into 11 1/4 degree, what we call houses. And within those houses, we learn what stars rise and set, and then we can orient ourselves based on that.
And what do you do if it's a cloudy day?
Actually, to me, a cloudy night is probably the most difficult time of navigation, because during the day, if it's cloudy, you can at least see the ocean. And that's really sometimes all you have is the condition of the ocean. So you're looking at the swells to be able to keep yourself on course. But it can be really difficult if everything is just black. So you're really relying on your feel of the ocean and the swells going under the canoe.
Navigating the ocean in the darkness by feel sounds challenging.
I would agree, but it must be a really incredible journey.
Thanks, Lindsay. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us on Earth Sky. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Black and White Years, 100 Flowers, Leather Bag, Mellow Grand, and The Heartlanders. For more information on the music and the science you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.